Bruce Jennings is the Director of Bioethics at the Center for Humans and Nature. He teaches ethics at the Yale School of Public Health and is past chair of the APHA Ethics Special Interest Group. He is also a fellow at the Hastings Center, where he served as Executive Vice President from 1991 through 1999. A political scientist by training, Mr. Jennings has written and edited 20 books and has published numerous articles on ethics and public policy issues. So Bruce Jennings first is telling us that the Hastings Center has new guidelines for in 1987 they had guidelines for the termination of life-sustaining treatment and care of the dying, commonly known as the Hastings Center guidelines, and these have been updated, and they now reflect 25 years of research, innovation, legal and policy developments, and consensus and debates on treatment decision making and delivery of good care in advanced life. So these are the guidelines that they've developed. And I think all of you are probably familiar what we die with. There's the number one cause of death is heart disease, and second being neoplasms. Alzheimer's now is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. And you may have seen this slide before, but people die differently depending on what their cause of death is. So there's different trajectories of functioning as we're dying. People who have cancer decline very near the end of life, and it's a pretty well-known trajectory, although people with organ system failure may have a more variable trajectory, and it's not a steady decline like you see with cancer. And with dementia, it's a more gradual, it's a continuous gradual decline, not the steep decline you see with cancer. So it's in particular these people who die with organ system failure and with dementia that we a lot of issues arise. So patients with decision-making capacity have a common law and a constitutional right to refuse medical treatment. Patients who lack this decision-making capacity have the same legal rights exercised through a surrogate. The basic right to refuse treatment does not depend on the prognosis or the projected life expectancy. Withholding, not starting, and withdrawing or stopping life-sustaining treatment are both forms of foregoing treatment. So these are the standards for surrogate decision making. So when a patient does lack decision making capacity, surrogate decision makers follow the following sequence. So first, if there are directions, explicit treatment directives, or other instructions in writing or orally, that's what the surrogate decision maker would follow. Second, there's something called substituted judgment. So if there's no oral or written instructions given by the patient, the surrogate bases decisions on the patient's own preferences and values as best they can be inferred from knowledge of and experience with the patient. Then, if there's no explicit directions from the patient and the surrogate lacks enough information to use the second standard, the surrogate should choose the treatment option that will be in the patient's best interest in light of the patient's diagnosis, prognosis, and treatment options. This is sometimes described as choosing what a reasonable person would choose if in a situation identical to that of an incapacitated patient. I missed one. As you know, the medical environment can be very hostile to ambivalent. The legal environment assumes ambivalence doesn't exist. Public policy assumes you know you want A, B, or C, but everybody's ambivalent when you get to this point near the end of life. Somebody is suffering, somebody else doesn't know how to make the right decisions about how to relieve the suffering, and there is conflict. And then you already saw this next slide, but this man looks pretty uncomfortable. Unfortunately, that's what a lot of people
Woody Allen.
Is that Woody? And it is Woody Allen. Oh, I didn't even realize this.
It's Sarah Palin.
No, I think that's and he's going, he thinks he has a brain tumor. He's going for the MRI.
They said he wasn't afraid of dying. He just didn't want to be there.
Yeah. It's funny, I looked at that and didn't realize. Okay, so the guidelines that the Hastings Center has developed are made for several different people. Professionals responsible for care of the patient will find these guidelines useful. Judges and healthcare lawyers and others involved in organizational policymaking can find these useful. Leaders of healthcare organizations providing life-sustaining treatment and/or end-of-life care find these useful. Professional societies may find these useful, as well as journalists, advocates, and others who follow these issues.
They might have something to do.
So how can these ethic guidelines help? The ethical guidelines that they've developed can give clinicians, clinical educators, and organizational policy makers a resource to turn to in uncertain and distressing situations when the right thing to do is unclear. They articulate the values that constitute good care. They recommend practices and policies that can advance this vision with reference to evidence and consensus. And they stay close to bedside realities and to the needs of good professionals working in flawed systems. So I haven't seen the guidelines, but it sounds like they're written at the level and with examples that would really make them useful to people. And this is just an outline of what is included in the guidelines. In the next few slides, I'm going to go fast through, because I'm going to skip, because they just go into detail what each section includes. And again, I can send you Bruce's slides if you want me to. What's in each of them. So one of the things emphasized in the guidelines is communication and the need for family conferences. It addresses disagreements among loved ones. It discusses nutrition and hydration, life-sustaining treatment and disabilities, communication when a disability affects speech, cognition, or both. The psychological dimensions of end-of-life care affecting patients, loved ones, and professionals, decision-making concerning specific treatments, and discussing resource allocation and cost of care. So this is titled, From Decisions to Systems. So Bruce Jennings says, if the hospital was once a place of too little choice, lack of transparency, involved paternalism, in recent years the pendulum has swung to the other extreme, and patients and families are now presented with an excessive menu of complex, always difficult, often bewildering clinical choices. I think we can all agree with that if we've had a loved one in the healthcare system. At an extremely vulnerable time for them and with little training or support, our system requires people to micromanage a confusing and emotionally explosive set of clinical responses to a recurring series of life-threatening complications within an underlying, progressively degenerative, or incurable chronic disease. Instead of focusing on how to accommodate the idiosyncratic decisions of individual patients, as it were, one at a time, we should ask what types of needs do dying patients generally have, and how can we design a healthcare system that will meet most of those needs for most of the people most of the time. So the guidelines provide a perspective on hospice and palliative care. They state palliative care is integrated with treatment, not limited to withdrawal of treatment, not incompatible with ongoing life-sustaining treatment. They talk about improved communication and access to palliative care and hospice care are needed. And they talk about attention to challenging topics such as palliative care, palliative self-sedation. I'm not sure what PAS is.
Physician assisted suicide.
And they improve collaboration between hospice programs and specialized medical providers, talking about better referral and improved continuity care between hospices and the providers, which is often an issue. Let's make sure it isn't. So then Bruce talks about the public health dimensions of end-of-life care and what the guidelines have to say. And he poses these questions like, in aging societies, how should care for people facing decisions about life-sustaining treatments and people near the end of life be organized and financed? How can preventable harms be avoided? And in terms of primary care and other community-based professionals caring for Medicare-eligible patients, he raises the question of how should advanced care planning and treatment decision-making be integrated into these settings? And in terms of community health centers and chronically ill vulnerable populations, the questions are, how should safety net providers collaborate to care for patients with life-threatening conditions and socioeconomic barriers to obtaining potentially beneficial care? Both Bruce Jennings and Dr. Morrissey have published on how care at the end of life is a public health issue, and it truly is, because as the population is aging, this is an issue for all of us. And as a closing, Bruce Jennings says, thank you. And I close with the thought that death is not the worst thing dying badly is. And while dying is an inevitable part of the human condition, dying badly is not. It is a correctable, ethical, and system failure. And I totally agree.